The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello, this is Tech Weekly from The Guardian, and I'm Alex Kratosky. On this week's program, we're previewing the biggest consumer games event in the West, the Electronic Entertainment Expo, also known as E3, happening this week in LA. We'll be discovering what Nintendo's new console is all about, plus trailing the big games that'll be landing on our consoles over the next few months. I'm joined, as always, by Charles Arthur, technology editor of The Guardian. Welcome to the podcast, Charles.
As always, you make it sound so bad.
Oh, it's one... No, as always. How's
can't
that?
Can't get rid of this guy.
We can't have enough of him. We want more, more. We want to put you in the presenter seat so that you can do more, impressions.
More Jeremy Clarkson.
Exactly. But we will be sticking to the United States of America for the rest of the program. After all, there's so much news coming out of Mercia that it's impossible to talk about anything else. In addition to Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney's App Store boo-boo, we'll also be speaking with Julia Schoppa, a California-based consultant who helps European startups ease their way into Silicon Valley. Keep listening to the next 30 minutes of Tech Weekly from The Guardian.
They never will. I'm Mitt Romney. I believe in America, and I'm running for president.
Last week, the internet was awash with jibes and jokes and ribs about Republican presidential contender Mitt Romney's new iPhone app, ostensibly titled Mitt Romney's America. A boo-boo in the system, however, meant that it was released with an accidental error in the title. In possibly the most important part of the message, the country in which he's running for president, Mitt Romney's Mercia. Charles, what is it?
Well, the idea of the app was that you could take pictures and then you'd put an overlay over the top of them and say things like, I'm with Mitt.
In Mercia. I'm so sorry.
And one of them was just a big logo showing the American country and the words Mercia
can you imagine Romney Central when that hit? Must have just died, and somebody's head would have rolled.
Probably someone said, hey, but it's good publicity.
Yeah, it's great publicity.
Everyone's going to talk about it.
They sure are. They sure are. And I actually think that Middle America, I'm so sorry, Middle Mercia, or, you know, certain conservative news channels will probably think, hey, you know, they're speaking to, you know, not everybody is...
They're speaking our spelling.
Yeah, not everybody is as, you know, as, oh my, anyway, yes. So why hasn't it been changed yet? Because as we're recording this, it's...
Has it still not been changed? I thought that some people had said that it had an update. Well, I guess it probably has to go through the Apple channels, which means that it has to be checked for, you know, how well does it work? Has it been, you know, propagated through the App Store? All those sorts of things. It just doesn't happen that quickly.
So basically what you're saying is that Apple is, if this is the case, if it hasn't been updated and it is going through the App Store, then the Apple process is actually prolonging the pain.
I did see someone say that, you know, if you think Mercia is bad, you should have gone to a Tea Party rally and seen how they, you know, how they write the placards there, because the spelling there is quite something to be seen.
Oh, this is going to be a really tough few months, isn't it, Charles? Yeah, head in hands. Now, what are some of the other digital offerings from the U.S. presidential race or notables from the past? I mean, Howard Dean's stuff seems to, this is in 1994, seemed to have been a pretty...
2004,
thank you very much. Howard Dean. 2004. I'm getting behind myself as opposed to ahead of myself.
Howard Dean, who was briefly a Democratic sort of almost a contender for about one primary in Ohio, sort of brought the idea of getting lots of little bits of funding and basically crowdfunding his campaign, which went great until pretty much the second primary, and then he just vanished from sight. But that has been taken up by Obama, who is doing much the same again, very much trying to raise money from individual voters to try to get people to feel that they own his campaign.
Do you think that's going to work? I mean, the notion of crowdsourcing funding is not new, and Obama did it too.
Did it very well in 2008.
Incredibly. And you know, he wasn't actually the first person who was doing it, because there were some other, there was a Nicaraguan election in which that was quite important, the crowdsourcing. There's been some really notable digital elections. Do you think, though, that after the big splash of Obama's campaign in 2008, where are we now? Yes, 2008, that it's going to be as effective? Or do you think that that was kind of like a one-hit wonder? It was like the one that people are going to remember.
I think that in that case, it was surprising and it drew a lot of attention because of the way it worked. But I think that now it will be part of the landscape. And so will the Obama on Facebook. And you know, Obama did a Twitter session more recently where he was actually the person who was doing the Twitter stuff. You know, when it comes to it, he's actually very good on the social media, the involving voters sort of side of things. Mitt Romney has an uphill battle there.
Well, we shall have our eyes peeled for more on the political landscape, the gaffes, and of course the apps, or the apps and the gaffes and the gaffes and the apps over the next few months. The Electronic Entertainment Expo, known as E3 to you and me, is the biggest consumer show in the West. Concerned with all things computer games, the Los Angeles Convention Center transforms into a mighty beast of cosplay and booth babes for an intensive week, as the big players waggle their silicon around in a rather unseemly fashion, showcasing their forthcoming releases and the next big things. Charles, what can we expect this year from the show?
Well, the big thing to expect is GTA 5 from the wonderful Rockstar, because they announced it last year and it's sort of gone underneath the radar very much. The Max Payne 3 came out. They put a lot of heft behind that. Now it's time to expect GTA 5 and all the delight that there will be there. And I'm sure that there's going to be lots of people in Parliament and so on who'll be preparing their blame for that, for, you know, all the joyriders and stuff. I remember when joyriders, you know, used to be blamed on GTA. I mean, it's lost its edge, hasn't it?
I remember when it was first talked about, you know, when it was first raised in Parliament, that was when it was literally the top-down game. It was only on PC. Those are the days. I remember, actually. Every year, GTA was released on my birthday, which I loved. Absolutely loved. Anyway, that doesn't happen anymore. But yeah, it was the top-down.
You changed your birthday?
I changed my birthday. I was like, I'm not being associated with this. No, it was a top-down game. And so it wasn't, you know, one of the things that people are complaining about with GTA and many of the other games that come from Rockstar or many of the other studios is their photorealism and the violence and the various, you know, the sexual innuendo, etc. So that it was raised at that time in 1998 when it first came out is fascinating compared with what they're going to raise now in Parliament about GTA 5.
It'd be interesting to do an archaeological dig through the games blog, wouldn't it, and find things you must have written about it in those days.
Absolutely. Well, I'm sure there were. Yeah. I definitely did not make myself a fan of Rockstar, or Rockstar did not. We're not fans of me. That's for sure.
That's why they got you to change your birthday.
Indeed.
So the other things that the principal things in the eye line would be Wii U. Where Nintendo was found having shocked everyone by originally, you remember they when they announced it was going to be called the Wii, and everyone went, "That's so rude." And now it's called the Wii U. I mean,
very clever.
What sort of name are they?
This is long term planning, I tell you. Very good, very good. Well, it was going to be called the Dolphin, as I recall. So it's a bit sort of rainbows and pandas, isn't it?
Yeah, they could have called it the unicorn, I suppose. I don't know, a dolphin's not bad. But yeah, Wii U has you know, a lot of people expecting. And of course, the real dark horses are, will Xbox become 720? Will Microsoft actually lift the veil at all on what's happening with the Xbox? Because, you know, this is getting old. 2005. That's a really old real device now.
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
Yeah, they've improved it in little ways, and they've stopped it dying of the red rings of death. But it's still not new. The rumours all are suggesting that the 720 will not have a hard drive, that you'll just be expected to load everything from the internet. A lot of discussion about whether that's a good idea or not. And Sony, will there be a PS4? Is it soon enough? My feeling is that it's far too soon to expect Sony to have written off the colossal cost of developing all the Blu-ray lasers and you know, the colossal cost of putting a Blu-ray drive into all those PS3s. They were a loss leader for years.
Yeah, they certainly were. And it has been fascinating to see how the horses have, you know, how the race has shifted, because PlayStation was by far the leader at the last turn of the console century. And once the Wii came out, seemed to have really shocked people, and the Xbox as well.
And yet Nintendo's now fallen into loss because they're just not getting enough of them to sell. And they do have a problem there. The Wii U can't really come along soon enough, and it needs to do something quite dramatic, actually, to gain back that feeling that they're driving things along. Microsoft is in a much better position. Xbox Live, all the interest around first-person shooters, they've really found their niche, actually, and it's a big, wide niche. By turning the Xbox into the living room device, the thing that you can get all your films and TV from, as well as playing games, by adding the Kinect to it, you know, they've really done a very good job there.
And establishing the community. They were really great at establishing the Xbox Live community, which, as you say, it's the sort of, it typifies the convergence movement within the games industry and then across the entertainment industry. But we will hear more about the Wii U, because we have an exclusive that's coming up later on in the podcast. But E3 itself, Charles, just what do you think is going to happen with this show? Because to be honest, I remember not being a big fan of it when it was around initially. It had turned into a bit of a really quite ugly, hairy monster there for a while. They did get rid of it. It was in sabbatical, and now it's back. It's been around for a few years. What can we expect from the show itself?
I think the big question for the games industry is what starts to happen when packaged software isn't the thing, when it all starts moving to the cloud, when you're downloading your games over the internet, you know, once speeds, you know, once broadband speeds start to get up.
More booth babes or less? Is that really the question that we're asking here in terms
I think
of
we
promotion?
Go more booth babes or fewer, surely. I was wondering if that's what you were talking about, shaking the silicon stuff. The whole thing of why booth babes? Well, it's sort of partly because that's the demographic that comes to E3, isn't it? Are absolutely going to be swayed, and they're going to say, I'll come to the E3 next year for sure. But for the industry generally, you know, we're looking at it ourselves. We're looking at how the volume of games sold through shops, and this is the problem that's hit game, the shops, has been falling. And it's really hard to make the charts sensible. You know, we publish the top 20 charts every week, and people keep saying to us, well, where's the digital one? And they are experimenting with providing the digital charts, and we do want to provide those. But the difficulty is, well, do you rank it by volume? Do you rank it by value? Do you rank it by some combination? You know, what do you do here? What's the best way to present this? And all we do know is that it's shifting very substantially, and it'll be really interesting. It's a bit like Mobile World Congress, which is where the mobile world gets together to talk to itself. A few years ago, it was all handsets and carriers, and the handset makers would go and sort of, you know, pledge their troth to the carriers and say, please buy handsets. Nowadays, you go there, there's gigantic areas which are devoted to apps. And the carriers go and try to persuade the app makers to be on their, you know, to be on the devices that they're selling. And the whole balance, the center of gravity has changed. And it's rather like that for games, you know. Will you put your game through my console is much more of an important question.
Or will you put it onto the cloud and let the indies chomp at it? Well, thank you very much, Charles. We will have more from the convention floor later on in the podcast, including, as I said, an exclusive hands-on with the Wii U. Watch out for all the games headlines, though, over the next week at guardian.co.uk/games. Now in the podcast, we have another dispatch from the West Coast of America. Julia Schoppa is an expert on helping European startups make the transition from over here to the Valley. Her company, Blackbox.vc, is a startup accelerator. Julia joins us down the line from Palo Alto, California. Welcome to Tech Weekly, Julia.
Welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us. Now, Julia, why should European startups be interested in going to the Valley?
Well, the reason is very simple and obvious. The VC community and the startup ecosystem here in the Valley is much older and much more developed than anywhere in Europe. So if European startups are thinking about going global and bringing their projects to the global market, they should rather start with Silicon Valley startup ecosystem and not with the European ecosystem of startups.
But why does it actually matter, though, if you think that, you know, it already is a global marketplace from the start? You know, you can have a Bulgarian address and be trading in Timbuktu. So actual physical location doesn't necessarily have any effect on what you do in the internet community.
Well, yes, but there are two reasons, two things that are much better here than in Europe. This is the access to very experienced mentors and advisors and serial entrepreneurs who have already built and failed or succeeded with multiple companies and multiple startups before. And the second thing is much easier access to funding and venture capital.
Surely, though, there should be, in some ways, a reverse. I can imagine that your incredible skills at working with startup communities, European startups in the U.S., and also working in the U.S. would put you in a fantastic position to inspire an incubator in Europe. And rather than just have a valley sinkhole, it could be quite fantastic to encourage a VC community, an angel community, a funding community outside the valley in order to encourage different types of startups and different types of incubating systems.
Of course. And this is what we are also trying to do. So our mission at Blackbox is to bring the Silicon Valley mindset and, the way the startup game is played here, to bring it to other countries all over the world. So that's why we organize these educational programs called Blackbox Connect, where we actually teach the VCs or angel investors or entrepreneurs from outside of the US about how to do startups or how to play the venture capital game by the Silicon Valley rules. And why? It's because the European ways of doing startups or funding startups are much different than here. For instance, European startups and European VCs are used to giving away a lot of equity for quite small amounts of funding. So when you take, for instance, Silicon Valley-based accelerators or incubators like Y Combinator or 500 startups, they usually will get like 10% of a company at the very early stage for up to 15, 20K. And in Europe, I met a lot of European entrepreneurs who would give away around 30% of equity in their company on the very early stage for much smaller amount of money. And the reason for why they accept these offers is that there is not a huge community of VC and not very easy. The venture capital is not very easy to access in Europe. So, you know, when you take the equation of demand and supply, it makes the VCs be on the very own winning position in Europe whenever it comes to negotiate the equity for investment.
I'd just question one thing. I mean, you say there that the European VCs basically tend to ask more because they can. I think it's a supply and demand thing there. What do you think about projects and sites, crowdfunding sites like Kickstarter? What's the potential for them? Because it seems like they can really disrupt the whole VC model, because effectively companies can just be themselves. They can do what they want to do. They don't have to give anything away. All they're doing is saying to people, give us some money and we will give you a product.
Sure. But I can't agree that the money is the only thing that a startup needs at a very early stage, because this is, you know, money is just the fuel that that facilitates or accelerates the development of a product. If you didn't have any money, you still can do your startup, but it will take you much more time because you will have to work and so on to be able to provide for yourself. But the crucial thing that you need when you are building a startup is the know-how of people who are much more experienced than you and who can give you advice on how to do customer development, how to pitch your product to customers or users, what kind of customer acquisition strategies to use, or how to build the user interface or user experience, and so on. And because the startup game has been played in the Valley for, let's say, last 15, 20 years, and the people here are much more experienced. And also, they are willing to share their know-how and knowledge with other people.
Isn't that the classic, we're not going to get disrupted sort of argument, though? I mean, what you say there about the expertise and so on, you can hire those things in. You can hire people who are good at UI. You can hire people who know about supply chains.
Yeah, but you need to know them before you hire them. And you can't hire people through Kickstarter, right? I mean, of course, I know a lot of startups from Europe and from the US who actually hire the core development team somewhere else. For instance, this pattern of hiring offshore development teams in Eastern Europe is pretty common here in the US. But nevertheless, outsourcing the core skill sets outside of the core team is not the best way to build your team and build your startup, because the highest asset of a project is actually the people. So that's why I believe that having Kickstarters or this crowdfunding platforms is not enough to build your startup, because, okay, it gives you access to the money, but it doesn't give you the access to expertise and skill sets.
Well, at the same time, one of the key elements of the valley that people talk about elsewhere is this idea of being able to fail, you know, fail more and learn from your failures. You know, fantastic, excellent, awesome idea. The optimism that is obviously in the valley is very much fueled by a U.S. optimism, as well as being fueled by the tax system, which allows for these types of things that isn't necessarily available to entrepreneurs elsewhere. So how can you teach entrepreneurs, get them, you know, inculcated in a valley mindset, as it were, and then send them back home when in fact the infrastructure systems don't support that mindset elsewhere?
Yeah, that's true. I totally agree with you. The Silicon Valley's culture really allows failure, and the permission to fail is something that is a core thing in this business culture here. And I observe hosting startups from Europe or Latin America or even Asia coming here to the Valley, they are usually very, very scared of failing with their projects. So that's why they usually pitch very tiny projects and small applications for iPhone or smartphones or small software as a service platforms and so on, because they are very, very frightened of the scenario that they could fail with this project. And they assume that having a smaller project will make the failure smaller and then thus easier to digest. Here in the Valley, the bigger your failure was, the more you learn. So people really appreciate having serial entrepreneurs who failed for a couple of times, because they seem to be very experienced and know a lot about how to fail and how to move on to the next project.
But see, they're also not bankrupted. So, you know, the tax system elsewhere would bankrupt them, frankly.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I don't have idea how to change the tax system in Europe. In a lot of countries in Europe, the tax system is really, really ugly comparing to here. For instance, in Denmark, there is this law that imposes higher tax rates on company shareholders who have less than 10% of the equity. So that actually makes totally nonsense to give equity to the employees, because they would have to pay higher taxes. I know that the Danish people are fighting with this law. Hopefully they will succeed. But that's true that this administrative and tax regulations in Europe make it much harder to fail and to move on.
Julia, thank you so much. And there are more startup stories at guardian.co.uk/technology. We've already foreshadowed what we're looking forward to from E3. Now let's find out the reality. The Guardian's games team, Keith Stewart, Steve Boxer, Simon Parkin, and Stuart O'Connor are on the floor.
Yes, Alex, the E3 conference is in full swing here in Los Angeles now, and I'm here with the Guardian's Steve Boxer. Steve, you've been lucky enough to get a first hands-on look at the new Wii U console from Nintendo.
Yes, and most exciting it was. Last year, obviously, it was unveiled for the first time, and it left people a bit bemused, but it's a very strange piece of kit. It has this bizarre controller that looks like a tablet, but if you ask me, I think it's a work of genius. Essentially, it's got so many bells and whistles, it's just unbelievable. It has a touch screen, it motion senses, it has all the sort of lovely things you'd expect to find on a proper controller, like dual analog joysticks and triggers and shoulder buttons. And the key thing about it is that flexibility allows it to create all sorts of mad new gaming experiences. Probably the key game that I played yesterday is clearly going to be a key game at launch for the Wii U. Is called Nintendo Land, and they describe it as a theme park for their sort of favourite franchises. There's 12 mini games in it, each with a sort of theme with a different Nintendo franchise. And probably the most, I enjoyed all three that I played. There was one where you had to hold the Wii U gamepad, as it's now officially called, horizontally, and swipe towards the screen, point it and swipe towards the screen in order to throw throwing stars, shuriken, at little cute ninjas. And that was brilliant because it sort of connects you with the TV. It's like the throwing stars sort of come out of the controller, and fantastically intuitive, but actually there was a bit more gameplay depth than the sort of simplicity of it would suggest. There was another game I played which was a sort of on-rail Zelda-themed quest thing which demonstrated what Nintendo calls asymmetric gameplay. A lot of the Wii U's games involve someone playing with the Wii U gamepad and other people playing either cooperatively or against you with conventional Wii remotes. And so this, I think it was called Legend of Zelda Battle Quest. I had the Wii U gamepad, and so I was an archer, and the other people playing just had Wii remotes, and which operated as swords, and they were obviously sort of taking on the enemies from close up, and I was taking them on from behind. And it was on rails, so you were sort of moving through the levels. But there were some classic Zelda-ish puzzles where you had to sort of shoot things with your arrow, and the people on the ground had to hit them with their swords, and that was fun as well. I could go on about Nintendo Land for hours, but it's basically, that is the Wii U's equivalent of Wii Play, which is a game that really shows the full capabilities of the machine. It shows you what it's all about. And most of the games in that are really quite unlike anything you've ever played before, which of course is what gamers crave above everything else. They also showed Batman Arkham Asylum Armored Edition, it was called, which is a Wii U specific version of, Batman Arkham City, not Batman Arkham Asylum, a Wii U specific version of one of my favourite games of recent years. And that firstly demonstrated that the Wii U, in terms of graphics processing, is roughly on a par with the Xbox 360 and PS3, which may sound bad given that Microsoft and Sony have new consoles sort of waiting in the wings, but at least it puts Nintendo in a ballpark which it wasn't in before as far as third-party publishers are concerned. So we'll see a lot more games aimed at adults. One game that will be coming out more or less simultaneously on the Wii U, the Xbox 360 and the PS3, for example, is Assassin's Creed 3, which is one of the big games for this Christmas. But for me, the Wii U is the absolute star of this year's E3. And I thought at the press conference today, Nintendo did a much better job of explaining what it's all about. There are a few unexpected games which looked fantastic, in particular this thing called Zombie U from Ubisoft. And also this mad sort of open world game in the LEGO universe called LEGO City Undercover. For me, E3 2012 so far, it's all been about Nintendo.
Thanks, Steve. And finally, quick one. When do you think we'll see it in stores?
Well, that was the one thing they didn't tell us pointedly, when it was going to launch or how much it was going to cost. And it probably won't be cheap, because you'd imagine that controller would be quite pricey. But it'll definitely be in time for Christmas, but it won't be very long before Christmas, I wouldn't imagine.
Thanks, Steve. And of course, we have all the best news, blogs and previews from E3 2012 on the site at guardian.co.uk/games.
And we will have even more E3 next week when they've come back and have recovered from their sunstroke and their jet lag. That is everything this week. Thank you very much, Charles, for joining us in the studio, and Julia for joining us down the line. Cheers as well to the games team in LA. Next week, we continue our E3 coverage. Let us know what you want to know at guardian.co.uk/technology. Go to guardian.co.uk/techweekly for all the links. The podcast this week was produced by Jason Phipps. I'm Alex Kratosky. See you next week.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.